Comments made on the Serotalk Podcast Network are those of the individuals and do not represent Serotalk Corporation, its staff, management, board of directors, or third-party resellers.
Triple Click Home.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Triple Click Home. On this episode, we'll be talking about the iPhone 4S. How has the market handled it as far as, is it getting a good reception now that it's been out for quite a while? We'll talk a Siri update, and we'll even delve into Google and Microsoft. Are they really handling accessibility the way they should? My name is Jeff Bishop, and along with me tonight we have Pete Bosley and Buddy Brandon. Hi, guys.
Hi, everybody.
Hey, Jeff, and hello, everybody, and welcome to the show.
So, Jeff, let's talk about the iPhone 4S launch and how that's played out. What are your thoughts? Has the kind of hysteria over the new phone worn off, and are people regretting their purchases, or do you think that that's become more of a settled in and everyone likes their device?
Well, it really depends on who you ask out there in the blogosphere. There's many that say that the iPhone 4 is not much of an upgrade, and then there are others that say that it is. People are really loving Siri, it seems, and many sales have been driven based on Siri alone, as well as the camera. But I think many people are saying that if you have the iPhone 4, it really isn't worth jumping from iPhone 4 to the 4S. I would argue the point. I love Siri and actually use it quite a bit. So for me and for, you know, the blind community, I think Siri is a great thing. So therefore, I think it is a must upgrade. But then again, the rumor mill is already starting with iPhone 5 and all kinds of things coming out next year. Of course, they're all rumors. So time will tell. A friend of mine asked me at work today whether or not he should get the 4S or wait for the iPhone 5. And my answer to him was, well, look, don't wait. You never know what's going to be around the corner. So if you can jump, do it. If you have a iPhone 3GS, then it's a no-brainer. Jump right to the 4S.
Yeah, I agree with you. I've been playing a lot with the camera and hoping that we would see some better OCR results. And it looks like the potential's there, although the control of the SDK really hasn't improved any. So it'll be interesting to see how these things play out as time goes on. But I'm with you on the Siri thing. Siri's great. It's surprisingly accurate. A wonderful achievement on the part of the Apple software engineers that have built it. And I do see people out there saying, oh, well, it doesn't do this and it doesn't do that. Well, I mean, I think it's important to realize that Apple has labeled this as beta, and Apple doesn't label things as beta very often, with the exception of things that they pass to developers for development purposes and testing. Apple's not a company that puts a product out and calls it beta. When they put something out, it's finished, it's done. So I think that we'll see Siri evolve quicker than you would ordinarily expect any other Apple product to be updated.
Lots of people have asked if it would make an appearance in Lion and in other areas of Apple products like Apple TV and all of that. And time will tell. We'll just have to wait and see. Sprint has seen record sales for the iPhone 4S, but along the road there, they've had a little bit of a bumpy start with the iPhone 4. They're having some data speed issues, and they say they're really working hard on that. And I think that's going to come down to getting rid of their unlimited data plan, but time will tell on that one.
What's really interesting about this is that I know some people that work in the industry, and I've talked to some of the engineers at Sprint, and they're having trouble reproducing these problems in-house, even though that they know that plenty of their customers are experiencing it and that occasionally they can reproduce the problem. But they're having trouble with consistently reproducing the issue. What is going to be very interesting is to see whether this turns out to be a baseband bug that's an Apple thing, or whether this turns out to be a bug on Sprint's end, maybe a misconfiguration in some of their software handoffs or something like that. Given the similarity between Verizon and Sprint's CDMA stacks, I'm very surprised that this is the case.
Well, and Apple has had some problems with the 4S with battery life issues. In fact, they've just come out in beta for developers, iOS 5.01. In fact, two different beta updates already. And I have not had a chance to put that, even though I'm on the developer program, I have not had a chance to play with that, and we can't really speak to it, but it really shows that Apple is very committed to making sure this gets fixed, and very quickly. They don't want this to be another AntennaGate type issue that they had with the original iPhone 4.
I think that the speed at which they brought out a developer build really speaks to how widespread the issue was. Personally, I did notice that my 4S tended to run down the battery quicker than the iPhone 4 did, but I didn't find it so egregious that I felt it necessary to really comment too much on it. In fact, originally I just assumed that it was my usage pattern that was causing that, but I do think that they will get a handle on it. I think that it'll be fixed in a relatively short period of time. What's interesting to me is that the iOS 5 release cycle itself was a little strange in that within the developer community, it was sort of felt that we would see a couple more betas before the Gold Master hit. And there were things that were broken throughout the beta cycle that are still having to be worked around by people that write apps that are a little bit surprising. So I think that in a lot of ways, this was Apple pushing something out the door before they were 100% sure that there were no problems. And that's again, a shift in behavior from them. And it's a little bit surprising and, quite frankly, for me, a little bit disappointing.
Well, the issues with battery life seem to be centered around location services, or at least some people think that's the case. And there's been some blog posts out there that say if you turn off set time zone in system services, that will help conserve your battery. Now, I've done that, and I have not noticed any improvement. If I leave the house at 100% and I get to work, I'm already down to about 89 to 85%. So it's pretty dramatic. Now, we do have Find My Friends loaded on our devices in our family so that we can kind of see where people are. And that probably has a lot to do with it because it's constantly reporting and, you know, reporting home. Hey, I'm here. Hey, I'm here. You know, so that probably has a lot to do with it. And I suspect that we're going to see that the amount of updates that are being done through location services might be minimized a little bit. I'm not sure, though. I'm not sure how Apple's really going to address this.
I think they're going to have to tighten up the API a bit. Right now, apps are allowed to request location updates basically at will. The developer guidelines ask that you limit the calls to the core location services such that you don't overwhelm the battery. But what's going on here is that I think a lot of apps may be improperly requesting more precise location data than perhaps they necessarily need. Foursquare is a good example of that. So, you know, the phone does keep a kind of cache of where it believes that it is close to. And I think that a lot of app developers will be asked to rely more heavily on that for sort of background-y stuff and only things that need precise location like GPS apps and things like that will continue to sort of hammer on the core location stuff. That's pure conjecture on my part. There is a little bit of diagnostics that I've done, but nothing concrete enough that I can say for sure. But if I had to guess, that's where I'd go with that.
I will say that if I turn location services off, that my battery really dramatically improves. So I really do think it is the key area that's probably being focused on right now at Apple. But, you know, we're not Apple, so we could be completely wrong here.
Before we move on to anything else, I want to talk real quickly about some of the things that have been posted out there. I know that a lot of people are concerned about the battery life issue, and there's been a little bit of misinformation, so I want to clear some of that up for folks. Under location services, there are applications listed that use your location, and it is safe to turn a lot of those off. If you do not use an application for the purposes of knowing where something was accomplished or something like that, feel free to turn those off. Under the system services button, there are a couple things in there that you definitely don't want to turn off. One of them is cell network search, which helps give the location of nearby cell sites. And the other one is the compass calibration. Those two items, you definitely want to leave those switched on or you will have problems. I've seen some people out there saying, oh, just switch all that stuff off. That's not a good idea. So just wanted to throw that out there just in case anybody had taken that advice and now wants to know how to get their phone back the way it was supposed to be working.
Let's keep on this battery topic just for a minute and talk about male for a second, because there's been lots of discussion on Twitter about this, and I just wanted to get Pete's opinion about this. I have an opinion, and I'll give it to you as well. But with the Hotmail now being integrated in iOS 5 and being automatically being able to be configured, it configures it as Exchange. So many people have asked, is it better to use Exchange Active Sync or IMAP? Meaning that if you use Exchange Active Sync, your mail, calendars, and contacts are pushed to you rather than IMAP, where you are pulling the mail. So from a battery perspective, what do you think, Pete? Do you think it's half one dozen or the other, or is there an advantage or disadvantage to either approach?
Generally speaking, I would say that the Exchange Active Sync is going to function better, and that is because that the protocol for keeping a low-level connection open with the Exchange server, or in this case, the Active Sync instance that's running on Hotmail, is very well-defined. It's well understood by most network vendors, and most firewalls don't cause problems with that. That having been said, a lot of IMAP servers these days do support the kind of long-lasting, non-repeating connections that just sockets just stay open waiting for those that kind of input and output. The problem with that is that a lot of firewalls and a lot of routers, especially older ones that aren't updated and configured correctly, will start to drop these connections after a certain time. So what happens then is your phone doesn't realize that it's disconnected. The server doesn't realize it's disconnected. When something happens that causes the phone to check for a connection, it tries to initiate a dead socket, and then it has to go back and create another connection, which starts to run the battery down. So I think that if you have a choice, definitely use the Active Sync, especially if you need to do the push and it needs to be immediate. Otherwise, set your IMAP settings on the phone such that they only retrieve mail once an hour or so. Don't be setting that to every 5 minutes, et cetera, et cetera.
Okay, so now I did some testing with this. I have a number of email accounts configured on my device. And I thought, all right, I'm going to try to narrow this down. And what I found was that if I configured Exchange Active Sync on an email account that had lots and lots of traffic on it, meaning email lists and that, I mean, you know, literally hundreds of emails a day, that it was better for me, at least on the iPhone 4. I have not done this on the 4S, but at least for me, under those specific circumstances, it was better to use IMAP and only pull once an hour than to actually have that mail pushed to me using Exchange Active Sync. So very, very interesting.
Yeah, it's always going to be better to only pull once an hour. Pulling once an hour over a real-time push method, that's there's never going to be any contest there, just right. By the nature of connectivity and that sort of thing. You know, the phone has to keep a network connection open constantly.
Well, but my point was that
it sort of does anyway.
Right. Well, my point was that if you're actually having mail pushed and you're getting lots of email list traffic, you're constantly getting email, you know, vibration alerts and all kinds of things, which is making your phone go crazy. If you're on 20 or 30 email lists on an account, you know, it's always pulling. So in those specific circumstances, you really need to evaluate on a case-by-case basis, I think, as to what strategy you would use. But I prefer Exchange Active Sync when I can use it. Just wanted to throw that out there because it's been a pretty lively discussion on Twitter and other forums. So
definitely, folks, if you have an account that gets a lot of email, if you don't need to see that email right away, don't use Exchange Active Sync. Exchange Active Sync is for those of us that work in an enterprise and we get mail that we need to see right away. If you are going to use Active Sync on an account like that, then filter everything that doesn't need to be seen right away out of the inbox so it doesn't get pushed to your device right away.
Or if you want your calendar and contacts synced to your device. Now, I use live.com for my calendar and contacts along with my wife. We share calendars and stuff like that using Live because that way we don't have to pay for an Exchange server, you know, hosting type solution. And I do that as well at the university. I pull using Exchange because we have Exchange in the cloud. At the university.
That brings up another good point there, Jeff. You don't feel like you have to configure your mail account one way. If you want your contacts and calendar set up through Active Sync, set it up through Active Sync. Just
right.
Leave
Turn the mail off.
Switched off, and then configure your email account as IMAP another way. So there's no one right way to do things. It's all about, you know, what you need as the end user.
there's so much flexibility here that you just have all kinds of ways of doing it. It might be kind of confusing to have it configured both ways, but hey, whatever works. It's all about conserving the battery as far as I'm concerned. A couple of games are having some issues in iOS 5, them being Stem Stumper and Papa Sangre. Stem Stumper came out with an update to fix their audio issues, and the game Papa Sangre has yet to come out with an update. And I guess this kind of speaks to the issue that you brought up, that developers are having to work around some iOS 5 API changes. And all I can say about Papa Sangre is, if you're wearing headphones and you're wanting to play that game, make sure your volume is very low. Or if you have any wax in your ears, you won't once you hear what comes out of those headphones. It's pretty dramatic. So if you are an owner of Stem Stumper, make sure to check the App Store and get your update. And let's just hope that the Papa Sangre folks will come out with an update so that we can continue to use that game. Now, one of the hidden payload features that didn't get a lot of talk during the announcement of the 4S is Bluetooth 4.0. Pete, can you... I don't know a lot about this myself, and I'm not even sure there are many devices that are even supporting the new 4.0 protocol, but can you talk to us a little bit about that?
Bluetooth 4.0 is a new standard that has just recently been finalized that is for kind of low-powered sensor devices, things like the devices that Nike used to have for their shoes, et cetera, et cetera. I was, frankly, very surprised to see that Bluetooth 4.0 was included in the iPhone 4S. And the reason for that is that traditionally, Apple does not adopt new standards quickly. They tend to be a lot more conservative about that sort of thing unless they're very sure that something's going to stick around or it's something that kind of fits into their strategy and their ecosystem. So they've either got some very interesting plans or they know something that we don't about what's coming down the pipes. Right now, there's really nothing out there that supports Bluetooth 4.0, and it'll be interesting to see how that evolves over time.
Well, the other thing is that they'll implement it if they get it first before anybody else can have it. Witness Thunderbolt.
But I think Thunderbolt fits into their ecosystem strategy that, you know, Apple's always been very big with high-end media production and high-end multimedia professionals, and that's what Thunderbolt is aimed at. Thunderbolt is not aimed at you and I. It's aimed at people that need ultra-high-speed data transfer between, you know, devices. And for most consumers, that's just not the case.
There have also been some audio issues reported on the iPhone 4S, and I personally haven't witnessed that at all. Have you, Pete?
I haven't really had any audio problems, although I do think that the speaker is somewhat different, and we don't have any audio files on this crew, but I'm not sure what it is, but the sound is subtly different, and I do notice that, but the audio issues that a lot of people seem to be reporting seem to be, again, application incompatibilities, and I'm not going to get too techie on you here, but the way audio is handled in iOS 5, and actually the way a lot of things are handled in iOS 5, changed with something called automatic reference counting. When Apple enabled this for new projects, they kind of threw a monkey wrench into things because I personally don't feel that it was very well thought out.
Well, but some people are reporting weird artifacts on phone calls and things. And I will say that I have noticed a difference with the microphone when I'm on a call, that my voice sounds a little bit distorted when I'm wearing headphones when talking into my phone. And that was not the case with my iPhone 4. It's very interesting. It's very subtle, but it's definitely there. So I don't know if it's my specific 4S or if it's just an artifact of the changes in the microphone or what it might be. But it's definitely there and it's definitely noticeable. So it's hard to say.
I've actually been told that I sound much better on the iPhone 4S because of the new noise cancellation feature. So I'm surprised to hear that. I haven't had any audio problems on the other side of things either.
Oh, no. People say that I sound fine. It's hearing my voice coming back through the headphones, you know, when I'm talking into the mic, you know, how you can sort of hear yourself if you're on, if you're on headphones, you know, using your phone, you can kind of hear your voice as you're talking.
You shouldn't. I can't.
Yeah, I've always been able to do that with my iPhone.
You've been 4. Able to since the 3GS, actually. If you have headphones on when you're on a phone call. Yeah, you do come back a little bit.
Yeah, you do come back. And I'm hearing a little bit of distortion when I talk into my phone. And so I don't know what that is. I have no idea. But
are you talking about the Apple earbuds when you're on your Apple earbuds?
I'm using some Sony ones right now with my 4S.
Okay. Yeah, it's not specific to any. It's just anything that's on the headphone jack. It's been that way since, well, I don't know about the first generations, but I've certainly seen it on the 3GS. It's
I'm going to go get my hearing examined. I can't hear it.
It's way back there. It's not terribly loud, but it's, you have to listen for it, but it's there.
But are you saying, Patrick, that you're hearing distortion as well or not?
Well, I don't have an iPhone 4S. I'm just talking in general terms here about the fact that you can, as far back as we've been able to use iPhones, you've always been able to hear yourself a little bit.
But you're not hearing distortion.
No, I've never used a 4S. I don't know about that.
But you're not hearing that on your 4 or your phone. Or a 3GS.
Well, yeah, it's filtered. It's very filtered way before it hits the cell tower, and that's, I think, what you're hearing coming back, but I don't know if it's different between the 4 and the 4S or not.
I'm not even sure how I could capture what it sounds like, but it's definitely a different sound than it sounds on the iPhone 4, that's for sure, at least to my ear, which, you know, my wife tells me sometimes I don't necessarily hear things the right way, but that's fine.
Remember that the audio codecs on cell phone calls are pretty narrow, so there's a lot of compression involved, and you just may not sound normal. I know that if I hear a recording of a cell phone call, it just sounds awful.
Yeah, and theoretically, what you're hearing through the phone coming back to you would theoretically, and I'm saying I don't know this for sure, but it should theoretically be pre-codec, post-processing whatever the phone does to it, but pre-codec.
Okay.
And welcome to our fourth chair for tonight, Patrick.
Oh, good evening.
That's right. And he'll be back later.
It took a while to get here, but
well, he'll be here throughout the show, but he is here really to talk to us about GarageBand, and that's coming up here later on in the show. So stay tuned for that. It's been a really interesting topic that people have been talking about on Twitter, and even Mike Calvo has chimed in and said, I can't get it to work. So the great Purdue will.
It's understandable, and I'll talk about that later.
Yes, exactly. Well, there's been a little bit of iTunes Match news. It never launched by the end of October like Apple had told everybody that it would. And along with that, the iTunes 10.5.1 beta release that was released to developers also expired. Although, I must say, it never expired for me personally. But Apple went ahead and put a beta 2 out. And so that's now available for developers. And it looks like it's going to allow us to actually do iTunes Match on the Apple TV as well. At least that's what blog sites are talking about. It was not something that I actually picked up from Apple, so I think it's safe to mention that here.
That should be kind of interesting. I'll have to, I'm an update behind on my Apple TV. I haven't seen anything for Apple TV yet as far as new software, so I'm not sure if they're going to spring that on us all at once when iOS 5.0.1 releases or how that's going to work, but it should be interesting anyway.
Yeah, buddy, I wonder if this will be something that they'll try to release altogether, you know, iTunes Match along with 5.0.1 and along with an Apple TV update. I don't know. That will be very interesting.
It was amusing to see as soon as November 1st rolled around, the blogs that gleefully pointed fingers and said, Apple missed their deadline.
Yeah, it's...
Nobody misses deadlines ever.
Well, you know, look, I'd rather them take the time and get it right, so...
No, absolutely.
You know, if that's what they need to do, then that's fine.
I'm right there with you on that.
Like they did with Lion?
Well, yeah. Enough said there. Now, we have a note here in the show notes about using iCloud with family accounts. And so you want to take a look at that. This really applies to those of you who have multiple devices and using the same iCloud account and how to sort of best manage that the best way.
Yeah, looking at that, there are some real pitfalls there that you can run into, and there are definite advantages and definite disadvantages to putting everything on one iTunes ID or on one Apple ID, above and beyond certainly the 5 gigabyte storage limit. Our house, we actually use 2 iTunes accounts and have mostly because Melanie and I have very different tastes in music and very different needs in apps. She has a lot of things that, for example, that she has put on her iPad for Alina for school. And those are things that I would really not be very interested in. So we use two separate accounts. But, for example, for home sharing, I have most of the music. So I would see that, for example, as one way that that we would want to use a shared account.
What's interesting about this, and this is what I tell everyone when they ask me this question, is that your account that you use for iTunes purchases and on the App Store and all that stuff has little to no bearing on which iCloud account you have. So I tell people, you know, set up a separate iCloud account for each device because you want those backups and those bookmarks and those things to be by themselves, unless you are one of those types of families that you all share the same interests, you've got all the same bookmarks, you don't mind that your photos will all be mixed together in PhotoStream, then, you know, by all means, have at. But otherwise, you know, go ahead and use the same account for iTunes purchases so you can all share your app purchases, but definitely stay away from syncing that stuff with iCloud.
Now, we already talked about Siri a little bit, and I know this is a pretty hot topic for Pete to talk about tonight, and we'll get right into it. So there's been lots of discussion about Siri appearing on the iPod Touch and on the iPad and all kinds of things. And Pete, can you give us an opinion on what you think is really going on here?
So some enterprising developers have managed to get the Siri functionality running on other devices. There is a lot of hope in the community that we'll see a possibility for jailbreak people to be able to use Siri. I personally have my doubts about that. The way Siri is architected, it's heavily reliant on some components that are only on the iPhone 4S, and it is specific to each device. So I find it unlikely that you're going to see a wide adoption of this, even if it is somehow made available, and here's why. In order to get the files you need in order to have Siri run on an older device, you'll have to have access to an iPhone 4S anyway. And while that may not be all that difficult to do, considering that lots of people have them, it'll have to be a jailbroken iPhone 4S, first of all, to even get your hands on the files, which hasn't yet been done publicly. And also, it'll be trivial for Apple to decide later that they're going to block specific hardware IDs because they were found to have been used from older devices. So I really don't see this happening. Our only hope, and it's a slim hope, is that Apple later decides, hey, Siri doesn't perform that bad on the iPhone 4. Let's go ahead and let them have it. That having been said, I do believe that we will see Siri on the iPad too. That's a guess. I don't have any inside information or anything like that. But I think that, you know, come the next iOS release for the iPad, we'll probably see Siri on the iPad 2.
Since the specs on the iPad 2, as far as hardware, are really comparable to what's on the iPhone 4S, I think that's probably a pretty good bet.
I think from a marketing standpoint, it's really bad that Siri is starting to appear on these devices, whether it's legal or not. And I don't know if Apple would fragment the product line. I mean, Siri was a huge deal for the 4S. So from a marketing standpoint alone, I don't think that Apple's going to allow this to happen. And rumors are that the iPad 3 may be coming out in the first quarter of next year. And if so, I think that's where you'll see Siri appear, as on the iPad 3. At least that's my guess. But you know what? We could be completely wrong. We have a couple of articles here related to Siri in the show notes. One being, does Siri really give Apple a 2-year advantage over Android? And I'm not sure about that.
Considering that, you know, somebody came out with a Siri clone, albeit very alpha, for Android within 8 hours, I'd say it's a stretch, although one could make the argument that where he's getting the 2 years, or at least certainly a lead from, is Siri's personality, and it's sort of people being perhaps more comfortable with it because it sort of has more of a personality than, say, the Android voice actions.
Pico? Whatever?
No, Pico's the
synthesizer.
No, the voice action, voice actions or Genie or any of those sorts of apps.
Iris
is the alpha thing, but there's another one called Genie, and there, I mean, like, Android has a few different voice interaction things, but they're by all accounts not nearly as personable as Siri. And I think that the psychologists and the philosophers are going to have a field day with this, because it's going to be interesting to see how people come down on this. Do we want our devices to have personalities? Or are we afraid of the robot uprising?
And here's the cynic in me coming out, and I just want to remind everyone that as cute and funny as Siri is software. Clever, pretty cool software, to be sure, but software nonetheless, and it is not inconceivable that someone could create a different personality-typed personal assistant for Android or you know, something very similar. So from my perspective, I honestly don't see that as being really a big deal. Where I really see Apple thriving in this is that Siri is heavily baked into their operating system. They've got some decent headway on interfacing with other things, and the potential exists that they will open Siri to third-party developers. And if they do that, then the sky is the limit. I can envision a day where every control on an iOS app has a voice tag associated with it, and you know, you could ask Siri to tap on this or do this or open that. So that could be very cool, and that could really kind of open up a lot of different opportunities for some innovation in that space. Whether that'll happen or not is another guess.
Now, I think you and I, Pete, are the only two that have 4S's that are here tonight, and so are you using Siri a lot on your device? Have you really found it to be something that has really made you a lot more productive?
I don't know if I want to say more productive, but I definitely find that it is easier for me to communicate with people. The messaging and the dictation has definitely increased my use of iMessage and text messaging and all of those sorts of things. It is very nice to be able to very quickly ask Siri what's on my appointment before I had to navigate to calendar. It's the little things, and they are very nice.
Yes, I do exactly the same thing. I text a lot with it, and when I get up and I'm on my way to the office, I ask it for my appointments for today, and that's exactly what I use Siri for myself. So it's really great stuff.
There's an article in the show notes as well that discusses how much bandwidth Siri uses. And that's something that I didn't really give much thought to. Of course, it's kind of silly that I didn't, because of all the bandwidth caps now on mobile providers and so forth. However, it's an interesting article with some interesting estimates. And to be sure, I was actually pretty surprised that the bandwidth usage for Siri was as light as it was. I think that it really doesn't use nearly as much data as one might suppose, considering what it's doing and so forth.
Well, I really think, actually, that the bandwidth that Siri uses, which is averaged about 63K per hit of Siri, is really quite a bit when you consider the fact that, you know, that's quite a bit of data being chunked down. That's a number of email messages. So if you are on a very limited data plan, say a 200 megabyte a month plan, that could really add up, especially if you use Siri a lot.
What's interesting to me is that Siri is not transmitting the entire content of your voice message over the network. So I'm curious as to what's being done there to cause that to be so intensive. I'm puzzled by that. That having been said, I think that there's ready access to Wi-Fi a lot of places, and a lot of us, you know, talk about our data plans, but, you know, in truth, I'm at home a lot, Wi-Fi at home. My entire workplace is covered by wireless, so when I'm there, I'm always on there. And, you know, Siri is always going to default to Wi-Fi, as is anything else on iOS, with the possible exception of MMS messages.
Well, I mean, that was where I was coming from, really, Pete, and you hit on what I think is the perception, is that that what Siri is doing is sending the voice data up and that's being recognized somewhere than the results being sent back. So since we don't know what is actually being sent up, and it probably isn't the actual raw voice samples and so forth.
We do know it's not that. Yeah. We do know that it is not the voice data. Yeah,
clearly it's not that because it's too small.
Yeah, the footprint would be huge if
Data. Well, exactly. And that's why I was surprised, because I sort of just assumed that that's what it did.
It's very interesting from an engineering perspective. It would be really neat to hear about what exactly is Siri doing on the device versus what is it doing in the cloud. And
One of these days, I'll sit down and I'll capture some packets and I'll find out. But if it's not encrypted, that is.
Very good.
And if you don't, I'm sure somebody will, and we'll find out about it somewhere on the interwebs.
Well, there are a number of other items in the show notes that if you want to read more about Siri, we have plenty for you to partake of. So definitely visit the site and definitely check those out.
I want to real quick mention one of them, these that I found interesting was kind of a more mainstream-esque article that says 10 things that blind people can teach us about Siri. So if you've got a few minutes, definitely go check that one out, because it was an interesting read to see how people kind of look in and see us from the outside.
The Siri co-founder at Apple has left. And so there's been a number of departures from Apple. Also, the person in charge of security at Apple is also gone. And that probably has
He did preside over the loss of presumably two prototype devices. I can see, you messed up. We'll overlook that. But the second time, it's like, okay, and even if it really wasn't this guy's fault, like they say, it happened on your watch. That's it.
Yeah, that's pretty bad.
Especially as, security focused or secrecy focused as Apple is. Yeah.
And buddy, this time went down a little differently. I think that there may be a component of Apple saying, hey, we need to get rid of this person because of what happened. And the details are still a little unclear, but it appears as though some Apple employees tracked the device to someone's house, presumably tracked it to their house. They called some people that they knew in the San Francisco Police Department. The police detectives went with them to this person's house, allegedly misled the homeowner into believing that all of them were police officers and that they were going to get a search warrant. Thus, the individual, fearing that that was going to be the case, allowed these individuals to search his house and his car without the understanding that the people searching his house were actually Apple security employees and were not San Francisco police officers. So there's currently an internal investigation going on, and it'll be interesting to see the results of that.
Ooh.
Oh, I'm sure there's going to be some wrist slapped over this, or potentially even some fines, if not some criminal charges. I would not be surprised.
In California, there are some pretty stiff penalties for letting someone assume that you're a police officer when you're not. So if that bears out to be true, these individuals that were Apple employees may find themselves in more trouble than they really want to be in.
Well, plus the guy who had his house searched, he could sue and win. Because I don't believe they found the device in his home.
Nope.
So very, very tough situation. Well, there's been some interesting Google news this week concerning Google Maps, and it looks like Google may be charging for high-end usage of Maps, and how funny is that, that Apple announced this week that they bought a mapping company.
Another
one?
We
have more information in the show notes about that, so yeah, very, very interesting.
Because didn't they buy a mapping company about a year and a half ago?
Yep. We knew that the Google Maps API couldn't remain free forever. I saw that coming when the Maps API first became available. You say to yourself, what's in it for Google releasing this API totally for free? And it was a solid API. So it's no surprise to me, at any rate, that we're going to see them start charging the heaviest users. And that's kind of something that anybody should have expected to happen. I don't know why anyone would be surprised by that, honestly.
Staying on the Google News front, they released a Gmail native iPhone app, and then an hour later, they pulled it.
Whoops.
Within that hour, the Twitter and blogs went ballistic over the app. It's not very good for sighted people, and it's definitely not very good from an accessibility standpoint. So
are we surprised?
With the native, yes, exactly. Stick with the native mail app inside of your iPhone and use it, because frankly, I don't really see any value in the Gmail app. We already have push notifications for email, and so I'm not really sure, unless one of you can really show me that it might have value.
I'm going to get on my horse here, because you know, a short time ago, I said something to the effect of, hey, you know, Google, thanks for stepping up to the plate on the accessibility front. We appreciate the work you're doing. And this was, you know, when we were talking about docs back in Sarahspectives. So now I'm going to be back on the other side here, and I'm going to say, Google, come on now. Like, you know that accessibility is important to us as a community. You have the development resources in-house, and Apple has pretty much built every tool that you might need to make your app accessible into the SDK. So the fact that this has gone on like this, and that your supposed awesome native Gmail app was largely inaccessible, is just flat out inexcusable. And we aren't going to let you get away with just sliding by all the time. Yes, we can use the standard mail app on the iPhone, and I probably would have continued to do so, but we should have had the choice. And you know, so shame on you for putting that piece of garbage out. Not that any of the sighted people liked it any better than we did.
Well, and another thing about that though too is, you know, kind of one step forward, two steps back. But you know, when Google makes another accessibility overture, how serious are we going to take them? I mean, yes, their approach to accessibility has always been haphazard at best. Scattered, perhaps, might be a good adjective, or half-hearted, certainly. But you know, when you come out with another thing, come on, where the rubber meets the road, we need to see: are you committed? Really, my answer to that would be no. They've shown that they're not, but they need to seriously get with the program here.
But here's what's the really frustrating part about it, though, buddy. The work that they've done, because they've been working hard on docs lately, the work that they've done there, even though they're not done and they still have more to do, shows that when they put their minds to it, they can do it.
Yep.
So it's not a lack of capability. This isn't a situation where it's, I can't, or I don't know how, or it's just, well, we'll get to it.
Yeah, it's not an I can't, it's not an I don't know how, it's not an I don't know better, because clearly they do know better. It's a I can't be bothered. It's not a priority, and it needs to be a priority.
Well, guys, I think it's as simple as this. I think that there are silos within Google, just like there are silos within Microsoft, because we see the same kind of things happening in Microsoft, too, with different product lines, in that the iPhone app development team at Google is probably a completely separate thread of the organization, and therefore they're not really interfacing with the accessibility team. Now, of course, should they? Of course. But I think that's what's happening here, is that you have little silos and they're producing things and they're putting them out there really fast because they want to be able to react to the market, and that's what's happening. So there's not cohesiveness, I think, across Google that says, you know, someone has not stood up at Google and said, we're not going to release a product from Google unless it's accessible. And that's what needs to happen.
I'm going to argue with you a little on the Microsoft thing. You know, yes, that has been true in the past, but all signs recently at Microsoft point to them really kind of getting it, surprisingly. The things that I've seen so far in Windows 8 and the kind of things that I hear from people that I know there, accessibility is beginning to be integrated into their security functions, which are plugged into all of their teams. So I think that we're on the cusp of a change at Microsoft, and a welcome one so far as I'm concerned, and that needs to happen at Google.
Well, that may be, but so far the past hasn't shown that. I mean, if you look at Windows Phone 7, for example, even with Mango 7.5, which was released, has yet to show any improvement for accessibility.
Jeff, you have to understand, Jeff, Microsoft moves slow when it comes to that kind of change, and I'm with you. Believe me, there's no excuse for Windows Phone. That never should have been allowed to happen. Don't let it be said that I'm making excuses for him. I'm not. I'm simply saying that at this point, I see some winds of change at Microsoft, and I'm hoping that what I think is happening is truly happening.
Well, the proof will be in the pudding, because, I mean, if you look at the you know, development tools team and you look at Office, you know, even they have been sort of, you know, doing the catch-up thing or even the seesaw thing between the Windows team and an Office and like Visual Studio. I mean, of course, they've made a lot of changes in the latest release and added a lot of things, but that took a long, long time coming. And so time will tell, but I really hope that you're right. And I definitely think on the Windows 8 side of things that we're seeing a lot of change there, of course. But that would be an interesting discussion for another show to talk about what really is driving that. Is it due to Apple, you know, or what really is driving that to happen? And why is it that Narrator is beginning to look more and more like VoiceOver? It's very interesting.
I think because they saw that VoiceOver works. They saw that what Apple has done works. Yeah. Apple did, I mean, and Apple hasn't always been great at accessibility either.
Come
Absolutely on, let's be real. Before 2005, there was a good gap of, let me see, I want to say,
right?
But I mean, between when Berkeley Systems, then and which then became Alva Access Group, stopped working on VoiceOver in the late 90s or early double zeros, and when VoiceOver finally came out, and there was no accessibility solution at all. You know, Apple had done not much of nothing. And before that, of course, all of the accessibility development and so forth was all third party. Even with the 2E, it was all third party.
Well, and let's remember here, guys, that Microsoft is coming off an era where they were the guys. And at this point, now that Apple has done this and it's seemed to work out okay for them, Microsoft is dipping their toe in the water saying, you know, look, Apple did it. To some extent, Google's doing it. We're going to do it because we need to stay competitive. And they can say that now. In the past, if Microsoft had introduced a screen reader with Windows XP that was anything more functional than Narrator, the traditional players in the assistive technologies field would have screamed bloody murder. They would have said, Microsoft is starving us out of this industry. And it would have turned into a situation where the Justice Department would have got involved and it would have been an antitrust suit. So now that Apple's done it and Google started to do it with Chrome OS and other things like that, Microsoft's in a position where they can say, well, the number two and the number three players are doing it. Now we're going to do it and, you know, we'll take the heat for that.
Well, listen, that came up many years ago. I mean, I was involved in those discussions and, you know, the AT vendors threw a fit when Microsoft even slightly, you know, with a little bit of smidgen considered even developing a screen reader. And, you know, the outcry from the community was just, you know, if they could have crucified Microsoft on a cross, they would have done it. So you're exactly right that would have definitely, you know, been the case. But, you know, some people think Narrator is a screen reader, which is a scary thing, but you know, definitely not really educated people, but many, you know, many do. So it will be very interesting to see, you know, what happens on that front, both from Google and a Microsoft perspective.
Oh, the times are a-changing.
Oh, indeed. Well, now that we've sort of started the little interesting discussions, let's continue them with this whole change in the sandboxing strategy on the Mac. And Pete and I have slightly differing opinions on this in reference to sandboxing and the use of the Apple App Store. So I will let Pete go first, and then I will give my opinion. And my opinion is not so much on the sandboxing, but on the App Store itself. So take it away, Pete.
So Apple has introduced what they call application sandboxing for the Mac App Store. And this was kind of hinted at when they first introduced it, but it wasn't enforced. There was no kind of clear guidelines, and we're starting to see some more details now. Essentially, what Apple was saying is by March 2012, was it?
Yeah, I believe so.
That's the date I saw.
All apps that are distributed through the Mac App Store are going to have to use this sandboxing technology, and the effect of this is really going to be very wide sweeping unless, you know, they dial back on
it. Hold on a second, Pete.
And essentially,
Pete, before you jump there, before you start getting into the more technical details, what is sandboxing?
All right, so application sandboxing is essentially an application is put into its kind of own virtual workspace, and there are only very limited circumstances where the application is allowed to look out at the workspace. And actually, in this case, the application has to ask for permission from various different frameworks to do things. And based on the application's entitlements, it will either be granted or denied. What this is going to do is essentially hamstring apps into very specific functions. So we'll see the loss of functionality in, I would say, at least conservatively, 60 or 65% of apps out there do things that they will not no longer be allowed to do after the sandboxing rules come into effect. Let me give you kind of a concrete example. Say you have an application on the App Store that does a find and replace in multiple files. Say, you know, you're a web developer and you've got a project and you want to change every word, every time you wrote iPhone with a capital P to a lowercase p, or sorry, vice versa, to make that correct. Well, in order to search a directory, the application would have to give you an open dialog for each file that it wanted to write or read from. And that just isn't going to work for developers. That's an unnecessary hamstring. When you talk about other things, hardware access is going to be curated as well. Apple's going to say you can only access these hardware devices under these modes, and if you want to do something with Thunderbolt or something that's not included in these frameworks, you're just out of luck. They're just not going to let you do it. So I think what this kind of goes back to is that Apple is an amazing innovator. Look what they've done to the digital music industry, and look what they've done to movies, and look what they've done to the mobile phone industry. Their innovation can't be ignored, but in the same breath, Apple takes such tight control over their innovation, they kind of stifle any third-party innovation that may be allowed to come along because they're so worried about controlling the whole of the user experience. It becomes this double-edged sword where Apple says, we have this new and really amazing and innovative thing, and we're only going to let you use it like this. And I think that approach has worked okay with iOS, but I don't see it on the Mac. And I think Apple's next step after requiring sandboxing is to say, you know, with our next version of the OS, we want to keep all your users safe from viruses and all that jazz. So we're only going to let you download apps from the Mac App Store. No more third-party installs.
Well,
and that's where I think we're going to come into a real problem.
Well, I don't know. I tend to disagree with you a bit on the App Store side of things. I think right now it's very fragmented. I mean, if you want an app, you either have to go find it on the web or you get it from the App Store. There's not one cohesive place that you can go and get all of your apps for your Mac. And, you know, I think that's really important from a consumer standpoint. And I don't really see how that would necessarily stifle innovation. Look, from a security standpoint, I see why they're doing the sandboxing thing. There's going to be more and more viruses written against, you know, OS X. And as the platform even, you know, gets more popular, hackers are going to try to, you know, get into it more and more. And even Microsoft is really starting to tighten things down too. So,
but let me ask you this though, Jeff. If apps have to know what they want to do ahead of time and they have to work within such tight constraints on the computer, you know, how is that different than requiring app approval on the App Store? And we've seen cases where relatively cool iPhone and iPad apps have been rejected because Apple decided they were either too close to their own Kool-Aid or they didn't like the way they did things.
That's true.
Ultimately, my question is, do we as consumers want Apple to decide what we want for us? And that right there is my biggest problem with them saying, hey, you know, we're going to curate things. Fine, the App Store is great. Make apps available on there for people to be able to go find them in one place. And I agree with you that the app discovery has been a problem for computer users since computers first came out. But I don't want someone to decide for me that I can't use a text editor that can do find and replace in all my directories because I might not know what I'm doing. I'm not going to live in that kind of world.
No, and I think that there will be ways, you know, around that more than likely. But I understand why they're doing it. I see the reasons why Apple is moving this direction, especially as more and more security threats to OS X are happening. I mean, it's all about making sure that the consumer is protected. And I don't know, there, you know, with security comes a cost. And I get it. I'm not saying it's right or it's wrong, but I understand Apple's position.
But I think that as consumers, we definitely need to be concerned about this because here's what it boils down to. If developers can't make compelling applications, then they're simply not going to write for the platform. They're not going to write for the small subset of users that will jailbreak their OS X installations so that they can install software the way they used to be able to. They're going to abandon the platform. And that's bad for everybody.
Yeah. It'll be interesting. I think what will end up happening here is you'll see this potentially change or evolve over time as the market, you know, sort of drives that. We've already seen that happen with Apple on other fronts as well. So time will tell.
I truly hope that you're right about that, because at this point, if the sandboxing app rules become a reality and I see signs that they're pushing for the App Store to be the curated garden of OS X apps, I'm done with the platform. That's it.
Yeah, it will be interesting to see. Although I really do hope that they put a lot more focus on the App Store for trying to get people to submit their apps to the App Store, because right now it's...
But who's gonna want to submit an app to the App Store that can only do a couple of things, though? That's what I'm saying. That's my problem
well,
with this.
I mean, my argument would be that those restrictions are in place on iOS, and when they have 4% of the market in reference to phones, and they have 52% of the market in the mobile space, so as far as profit margin. So I know you said that it may or may not really coincide together from a difference from phone to Mac, but I think it does. And from a consumer standpoint, I don't really see that the consumer is going to, you know, see much of a difference. So, but time will tell. I could be completely wrong, and, you know, I'd be happy to admit it. So time will tell. It's an interesting dilemma here.
Buddy, we've been going at it hot and heavy. What do you think about that?
I don't know. I don't think I have enough knowledge to speak intelligently.
Well, we'd love your feedback. So
spoken like a true diplomat.
There you go. We would love your listener feedback on this. And if you'd like to call it in or email us, we'll give you all the contact information at the end of the show. But we would love to hear your feedback on this one. It would be an interesting, lively discussion for the next edition of Triple Click Home.
The one question I do have, though, is how is this going to affect accessibility?
I honestly don't think it'll affect accessibility much at all. And the reason for that is that the accessibility tools and frameworks are kind of built in system-wide. So we won't really – I don't think we'll really see a problem or necessarily even a help there. But I do think that the user-facing side of things are going to get interesting.
Well, I would argue that it would make a difference. We already see that on the Android platform – that there's so much fragmentation that accessibility is, you know, a hit and miss on that platform unless you jump through hoops to get your device to a state that's equal to everyone else. And we already see this with jailbreak apps that are out, you know, if you jailbreak your device, and that those apps may or may not be accessible. And so, I don't know. I think, you know, it very well could impact that in the future. It's hard to say. All right, we'll be right back right after this.
My name is Meera Batra. I have been in this country 32 years, and this is how I live united. America has always been the land of promise, and in my community, many families have come for a better life. Coming from another culture myself, I know the desire to become part of a community, to feel at home, and to gain the tools for our children and families to succeed. So I advocate for these families with United Way. United Way empowers them to look beyond their histories and to see what opportunities are available. We help them get involved with their kids' schools, network within the community, and when we do, we unite them. We make the community stronger. What I do is something I wish someone had done for me, and I am so grateful I am able to. My name is Meera Batra. I help families see opportunities and succeed. I don't just wear the shirt. I live it.
Give, advocate, volunteer. Live United. Go to liveunited.org. Brought to you by United Way and the Ad Council.
The Steve Jobs book has come out, and a lot of us have read the book or are in the process. It's about a 26-hour audio book. And let's just first find out who's read it. I'm not finished with it quite yet, but I'm loving it. And Pete or Buddy, have you read the book?
I have read reviews of the book, but I have not started the book yet. It is quite long. It's really interesting. Even the abridged version, well, actually the abridged version is quite a bit shorter. Like, they cut a lot to abridge the abridged
version.
Oh, I
wouldn't have read it abridged.
I read the whole thing.
Did you?
I read the whole thing, and I'm done with it. And it was a pretty amazing read. And I think the one thing that I took away from this book that was maybe not necessarily what people had in mind, but, you know, Steve was just a regular guy. He accomplished some amazing things, and definitely brought us some amazing products. But, you know, at his core, Steve is just another guy. He could be pretty mean and pretty arrogant sometimes. But, you know, I think we all have that in us. So, you know, hey, just a regular guy.
Albeit a fairly eccentric regular guy.
Oh, for sure.
Absolutely. There's been a lot of media coverage on this. 60 Minutes did a whole show on it, including the use of children with autism and the use of the iPad. If you have not had an opportunity to see that show, that's one you really don't want to miss. It was really fascinating. PBS also did a interview with Steve Jobs that has never been seen before, as well as just covering him. So we'll have a link to that in the show notes as well. And Steve Jobs, the movie. Yes, that looks like that's going to be coming as well. Refer to the show notes for additional information. And last but not least, here on Triple Click Home, we want to talk about the newly released GarageBand iPhone and iPad app. And it's Universal app. It's even available on the iPod Touch as well. And
and the iPhone 3GS.
Yes, it's everywhere. It's everywhere. And, you know, there's been some interesting discussion about, well, is it accessible? Is it not accessible? You know, it kind of depends on who you ask. Even Mike Calvo has had some difficulty getting it to work. So we thought we would bring in...
Mike had difficulty getting something to work?
Yeah, that's amazing, isn't it? Yeah, well, you know.
Stop!
Had a discussion with him on the phone about it. He said, I can't get the thing to work, and some people says it works, and, you know, anyway. So we thought we would ask Patrick Perdue to come on and, you know, since he really is all things audio and all that kind of fun stuff in production. So we thought we'd ask him to come on and find out if he had a play with it and to find out what his opinion was.
Well, it turns out he has, in fact, had a play with it, and he does have opinions on it. I've been playing around with this thing since Wednesday. When did it actually come out? Tuesday, Wednesday, something recent.
I think Wednesday, wasn't it?
Yeah. So I got it on Wednesday, and I can understand why Mike and others have had issues. It is, at first, definitely a very, very obvious object in frustration. It's... Let me just come out and say, as far as I can tell, now that I know a few things, it's all basically accessible. It's everything's there if you know where it is. If you're like me and you're just kind of swiping around the screen, that's not going to work. There are a bunch of things you're going to miss if you're just you know, doing the whole left-right flick thing and stuff. You actually have to be very tactile. You have to know where certain things are on the screen. But once you figure out a couple of things, it is a whole lot less frustrating, and I've found that out.
Have you had to turn VoiceOver off and back on again to get it to function, or are you able to stay, you know, inside of VoiceOver while you're using it?
There is only one time where you have to turn VoiceOver off, and this is a known bug. I've done some research, and apparently this is a known bug. If you, for example, go into the list of instruments and you pick a drum kit, I guess on screen it looks like a drum kit. You actually have the kick and the snare drum kind of on the bottom, and then you have... the toms arranged like they would be on a kit, your crash cymbal and your hi-hat kind of on the left, floor tom on the bottom right, sort of like you might expect. But when you select a drum kit and you press one of the drums, VoiceOver doesn't basically work anymore. It doesn't control, you can't do anything with the screen with VoiceOver. You have to turn it off and back on. That's the only time I've seen VoiceOver do something a little bit weird. Everything else seems to work fine. The on-screen keyboard, which is really cool. If you've used anything in the past like ThumbJam or MorphWiz or any of these other things with virtual keyboards, you have to turn VoiceOver off to make those work. With this, not so much. They've obviously used some bit of the API to control that properly, so you don't have to. But there is that issue with the drum kits.
Now, I had heard from someone that there's a rotor gesture to turn on direct touch to allow you to have more interaction with the actual app, along with VoiceOver. Do you know anything about that?
I don't, actually. Like I said, I haven't been playing with it too much, but I've gone through the basics. I've figured out, you know, one of the things that, just to get through this a little bit, one of the things that frustrated me to no end until I tried something that I don't know why I didn't think of before was, how do you get to the instrument categories? It wasn't very obvious. There's a button on the top left corner of the screen that is, according to VoiceOver, called To Over Home, which I guess is the home button. And, not sure why it's labeled as such, but press that and you press the instruments button. That takes you to a list where you can get basically a few different track categories. You can have, for example, keyboards is the first thing that comes up. And within keyboards, you have several different categories. You have, you know, pianos, organs, synthesizer type sounds, a few other things. But if you want to use drums or if you want to record live audio, there's a specific category for guitars. If you have one of those accessories where you can plug your guitar into your iPhone, for me, when I first started using this thing, it wasn't obvious at all how to do that. But it turns out all you need to do is flip through pages like you would flip through pages on an app. It's not obvious that they're pages, but if you do that, it makes things a lot nicer.
Okay. Very good.
That's something that that really, really bugged me hardcore when I was using this. I found ways to do it, but they weren't consistent. And this one is. Once you get to the right place, it works every time.
Triple click home.
So we wanted to thank everyone for listening to Triple Click Home. I know that it was a little long in coming, but we hope that you've enjoyed it. If you have things you want to say to us, you can follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/tripleclickhome. You can also follow us individually on Twitter. I'm Peter Bosley, and I'm at twitter.com/PBOSSLEY.
You can follow me on Twitter as well, Buddy Brannon here at twitter.com/BBrannon. That's B-B-R-A-N-N-A-N.
And you can follow me on Twitter, Jeff Bishop, twitter.com/JeffBishop.
And if you really want to torture yourself, you can follow Boris in a box. That's B-O-R-R-I-S in a box.
And Jeff and I are going to now go to a bar and have a drink and make up.
Yeah. I love you, man.
Thanks, everybody. We'll see you next time.